And we're going to interview Bob Plums, or whatever his name was.
No, that's for the next
episode. That's for the next show. And Donald's Plums.
Never mind.
Hello, welcome to Lug Radio, Season 4, Episode 2.
Hello, welcome!
Hello!
We're back, it's the next episode in the Season 4.
Do you know, we say we're back at the beginning of every single episode.
We say, it's because we're back.
You should actually try it just one day. And it's not us, it's somebody else now. Oh, wait.
It isn't us, it's you.
Scott Strange frigging Remnant, who appears to be in the studio.
At least they didn't get called Three Shot yet.
Yeah, Three Shot Remnant.
Right, well reminded. So, Scott James Remnant.
Yes, I'm Stuart Langridge.
Yes, I'm Matthew Revelle.
Yes!
I'm Abe Batchel.
No, I'm John O'Bay.
Oh, you funny boy. So, what are we doing in this show?
Action packed.
It is packed with action.
Well, so we're going to speak to him.
We're going to speak to me.
We are about...
Matt points to Scott.
About Upstart, which is a revolution.
Which is really interesting, honestly.
It is a revolutionary project turning over the last 30 years of Unix hacking.
He is a legend. He's got a glow around him.
Interviews.
We've got interviews.
We have.
Oh, yeah,
we've got an interview with Pierre War.
Pierre
War?
Yeah, we're not talking about Bob.
It's not called Bob Plums.
I thought we were not talking to anyone called Bob Plums ever.
No. And we're going to talk to Peter about Software Freedom Day and how exciting that was a few days ago.
We're also going to talk about contributing or just fucking off.
Yeah, should people contribute and, you know, if they don't contribute, should they fuck off? You know, yeah. we're gonna discuss.
We've got your emails. Was there something else we talked?
Yeah, oh, yes, there was indeed.
It was some kind of distro.
Distro-based discussion.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
What was it called?
Distro.
So let's get the show on the road.
Yeah, nice one.
Go.
Distro. distro.
Distros.
Okay, so in this segment we're going to talk about what distro we think we are. If we were a distro, what distro would we be? And also, what distro do each of us think each other is? if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
How misunderstoodness have we got?
Well, you've got no names.
That makes sense in Birmingham.
It's a segment for six-year-olds. Go first, O'Bacon.
Yeah.
Ah.
Well, if you were a distro, what do you think you'd be?
I'm a distro. Which distro am I?
I don't know. I mean, I'd say, rather unsurprisingly, I'm going to say Ubuntu.
No.
Yes.
Always behind the times.
You shut your face.
copies all his good ideas from someone else.
Often breaks.
Brown inside and out. This was
You finished.
Why, Jono, why?
I'd say that...
why?
Because I've got an understanding of free software and of community. Everybody loves me. Yes, I'm brown all over.
Breaking.
But I'm not embarrassed about it. Yeah.
Every month you have a new picture.
So who's your counsel?
and importantly, whenever you need to do any real work, you go back to being proprietary. Cubase, Launchpad.
How about you shut up?
That's like Launchpad.
So, yeah, I'd say...
Possibly.
I'd say Ubuntu. I think
I'd put you down as Ubuntu, actually, to be honest.
Yep.
You're a kind of a happy compromise.
No. Linspire.
Linspire.
He's not Linspire.
I could see the Linspire. You're kind of, you know, bigger, trying to appeal to the ordinary common man, and that's what's important.
Getting Windows users over using to Linux.
Yeah, I did click him once, and he did run.
Was not much longer. I mean, a warehouse.
But now when you click him, he doesn't run because he's free.
Unless you go for the golden option. Anyway, so I think Linspire could be a good one for Jono, but it's not quite contributed to enough in the way of very obscure things that no one's ever heard of.
like Jacosha, for example.
Also
Okay. So,
Scott James
Remnanto.
Special studio guest.
Well, I think I'm Gentoo. I think I'm vaguely difficult to get on with at times. High maintenance.
Vaguely difficult to get on with?
Yes.
Gentoo.
Well, you know, it's high maintenance.
It's hugely difficult to
But it's very rewarding once you kind of get into it. And I mean, indeed. You know, a slight tendency to NIH things at times and write things themselves.
Not invented here. Plus, this isn't a personal ad, dude. I'm great once you get to know me.
I'm happily married.
Humor.
Does that all make you perform better, though?
Oh, well.
Ah, comedy gold from behind. So, do we agree with Remnant? Is he gento?
I think that 11-year-old to 16-year-old children everywhere love him. And that pretty much sums him up. He's way too difficult, and no one likes him. I'm only joking. No, gento, I'd say slackware.
Yeah, because
Gentoo's a bit too obscure. I mean, I don't know Scott massively well, but I know that he's, you know, pretty straight down the line.
You're saying it's got no packaging system.
It's got no package.
Yeah.
Harsh. But yeah, no, I'd say slackware because it's kind of appreciation of the technology.
Traditional.
But there's no bullshit there, you know.
Yeah.
So, kind of sums it up, right?
Difficult to get on with.
Again, difficult to get on with, but doesn't feel the need to trumpet is difficult to get on with as a positive bone.
Right, ging-a-ling-a-ling-ling-ling-a-ling-ling-ling-ling.
Right, okay, I reckon I'm like Debian, the kind of, you know, go for the free software stuff, but the whole point about Debian is that it's enormously popular and people build stuff on top of it
and
all
it just works.
And, it ought to be a kind of, some fork of Debian that not many people use.
So you like Debian in the sense you've got multiple personality syndrome.
And you never release anything.
Well, that's such a big lie.
three words. Linux from scratch.
You are,
as Matt once said, deliberately difficult.
That's completely untrue. Plus,
rather unnecessary at times.
Importantly, Linux from scratch aren't deliberately difficult to do. They're trying to make a quite hard process easy to you.
I'm in the process being difficult.
I'm just proving myself
to be Linux from scratch.
Yes, you are.
I quite like Linux from scratch. I've occasionally thought about doing a Linux from scratch thing. So
haven't we all?
So and have you done it?
No.
No, neither have we. But, okay.
You have a wife and child.
I'll cough to being Linux from scratch. I'm Linux. Oh, that sucks. I'm Linux from scratch.
Yeah. Adored by 10
Millions.
To 15 people.
Adored by fizz, basically.
Adored by beer.
Sorry, Wolf's lug-in joke there.
But on the other hand, I mean, I could do with being adored by 10 to 15 people is 10 to 15 more than aid. So
whatever.
Farewell, later.
Hello, Matthew Revell here.
And if I was a distro, I would be.
Yes, if I was a distro, I'd be Susie. Mainly because, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I reckon...
You're quite pretty, but very expensive.
Well, no, because obviously OpenSusie.org is now free to download. But
if you can find the link on that.
It's quite good that Matt's not wearing some free tat as he normally wears. He normally wears a free tat t-shirt when he comes to look great.
I'm wearing tat that he had to pay for.
Well spoken.
Chosen tat.
I've never seen Susie wearing a vicar jacket.
Shut up. I haven't got that one. Anyway, I reckon I'm Susie, right? Because I'm kind of... I look good on the outside. Because I got my own hair.
Because you cut your own hair.
I reckon I'm Susie because...
If you knew Susie like
I... Hear my song. Anyway.
Come on, Matt. Focus.
So, Susie, right? I'm Susie because I kind of look good on the outside. I'm all shiny and you know, not too blingy, but all shiny and everything. But underneath, I'm lacking in some vital areas, but I managed to make up for it by just kind of blagging a bit and having Ted Hagar preach for me instead.
I reckon you're Linspire.
No,
you are. Run Linspire.
You just want it to work with the least bit of effort.
Yeah, but I think Ubuntu does that, and I wouldn't say I'm Ubuntu because I'm not well-rounded enough or in my Linux knowledge.
Quite well-rounded.
But you appeal to the common man.
Do I, though?
There's a certain amount of what it looks like is more important than what it is.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I'm a pond.
Kind of vibe, which is Linspire and Matthew P. Revett.
Just that he's called Susie.
And well, is somewhat misunderstood.
I'm not that shallow. I just make up for what I don't know by bragging.
You're misunderstood,
which is
like
essentially how Johnny got where he is today.
Yeah, very true.
What did you say?
Ah. Teacher, listen, mate.
my insultometer kind of started flipping.
Went to 11 there.
Hey, Bradshaw. Hello. If I was a distro,
What's it going to be, Abe?
CentOS.
Oh, weird.
taking some stuff from the corporate world and taking some stuff from the free world.
And making it not as good.
Nice and easy to use. It's stable.
Beard.
Okay.
The whole point of CentOS is they took a thing that was basically, you know, pushed as a commercial proprietary thing and made it free and available to people without paying the money.
Yeah.
Which means that they were, you know, taking something corporate and bringing it into the free community.
Well, I'm something
corporate.
In what
way have you done that?
I'm something corporate, but I'm in the community.
I say,
care in the community.
Give me an X.
X.
Give me an A. Give me an N.
Zandros.
Give me a Dross.
Zandros. That's what you are.
You're Zandros.
What in
well,
the,
thank you.
In that he's really old.
No, he's Yggdrasil because he's really old.
He's Zandros because he claims he's into free software and
yes.
gives
nothing back.
And as Stuart Langridge once said, he loves the C drive.
But no.
I don't love the C drive, as you well know.
That's an unfair characterization.
Really?
Zandros
on a show like this?
It's as if we've done this segment before.
we'll probably mention his wiki in a minute, if we had done that.
Yeah, let's mention the wiki.
This is your perfect opportunity to prove that you do take things from the corporate world and give them back to the free community, right? Aid Bradshaw
has
a wiki
where have you taken from the corporate world and given to the community?
You're not Robin Hood.
Well then what? The JavaScript libraries that I wrote at work.
Okay, fair enough.
Next question.
A backpedal.
Right. Anyway, perfect example. Aid has a wiki full of documentation. He's spent 5 years building up.
Just documentation, but documentation about open source software.
Exactly.
Free software.
Useful tips and tricks that he's put together.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got all this stuff on a secret private wiki that no one else is allowed to know about, apart from apparently us now.
It could be wrong. It's
inaccurate for all I know.
Yeah, but the whole point is, why do you rely on it? It works for you, exactly. Release.
It's just notes that I've taken.
Yeah, but people could update that. It's your wiki's not the fucking Linux documentation.
It wouldn't work for me anymore.
Aid, it's just notes that I've taken.
Yeah.
That is what blogging is.
Yeah.
And everyone's going nuts about
blogging. No one's
going to
be interested in how you get NTP working on a Cisco router, are they?
A lot of people are working on a Cisco router.
You were interested, right? Because you did it.
Remnant's got a stalk on right now.
thinking about that. Remnant's actually nursing a semi just at the mention of the network time protocol here.
A semi by the sea.
So, I mean, come on, you found it useful to know. Do you believe you are the only person who will ever need to know that?
So you think I should blog all of those articles?
I think you should either copy your wiki and put the copy online, right, or just put your wiki online.
It's the Aid documentation project.
It is.
That's the thing. It's not. It's really terse. It's just enough to get it working.
But some documentation is better than no documentation.
It is.
And it's probably wildly inaccurate. I'm quite happy to put it online. But
do it.
All I'll get is a load of people saying, "No, you're wrong on that line there."
No, at that point, you go, "Whatever." Update it if you want to. It's a wiki. And it'll
no,
come up, and it'll come
because
up
people
Google.
Will spoil it.
No. I'm not necessarily
people
just in...
People will spoil his fun
there's nothing
in Wikiland.
There's nothing stopping you keep... Yeah, fucking Wikipedia. People might log in and spoil it. Oh, no, what? I mean, if you want to, take a copy of your wiki, put the copy online,
right,
and then occasionally look at the copy and cherry-pick the best bits back into your own wiki.
But you see...
If you're worried that people are going to come in and just spam it or delete it or update it to be wrong or not relevant to you...
There's a flaw.
But
so
it is
long.
Relevant
to there's a flaw to this plan. That involves effort.
Aid doing yes, it does.
A busy man.
Lazy.
Yeah. Busy doing fuck all.
Hang on. How long does it take you to type the command rm.htpassword, it'll take to make it live and online. It would be public now if it wasn't for that you'd protected it and no one's ever linked to it.
I'm sure there's
we'll
a page.
We'll link to it for you.
I'm sure there's a page in there saying, how to make my wiki available to other people.
There's a new one.
Actually.
That'll be in recent changes, won't it?
it's massively... like you say, it's not a comprehensive set of documentation, but it's useful.
And you seriously think
time.
People
yeah.
are going to be interested in
I
it?
I really... I'll tell you,
yes.
just put it online,
yeah.
and then after... Stick Google Analytics on it or something, so you get
the hell's
accounts.
That?
Or some other web monitoring thing.
Okay.
You know, and then after a month, once Google's had time to index it, see how many incoming search query stuff you got.
Right.
And then put Google AdWords on it and make a mint.
Okay, whatever.
This
I'll
is
give
why
it a go.
Matt's a marketing guy and I'm not, because I never went that far. I thought, put online, people will share the knowledge.
People will enjoy the knowledge.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me it could be a money spinner.
But just leading on from that, I know we're kind of going off topic, which is ever so unusual for Log Radio, but there's been times when I've written something on my blog, or he's written something on his blog. Like, I did a little tutorial about how to use GStream and Python.
These
and
aren't
I
didn't, tutorials, is my point.
No, but the point is that basics. I put like bits of information on my blog about stuff, and Google's picked it up, and people found it when searching for it.
Yeah.
And they found it useful, and they started commenting on it.
I get about... Go on. I was just gonna say, I get between 10 and 15 people a day coming to my blog with this Google term automatic shutdown in Ubuntu. Right. And all I did was, it wasn't working with my ATX case properly around the Dapper beta time.
Okay.
So I just typed up a little blog post and said,
this is how it works.
Exactly. And people seem to find that useful.
The next,
but
how,
don't
when
then
you
loads of people
out?
Who own obscure motherboards start emailing you for personal support?
No, they don't.
Gives a damn. Because
there's no reason why you can't ignore those emails. And if they email you, you just go, whatever, dude. I mean, seriously, right? When you wanted to find out about setting up NTP on a Cisco router, what did you do? You typed in NTP on Cisco router into Google.
No, I didn't. I typed NTP space ? And it's a bad example, but
okay, but if you had a, I mean, lots of people are not going to think to do that, to be honest with you, and they're going to Google for it. They're going to type they're going to type NTP Cisco router into Google, your page will be the top hit, and it'll explain how to do it.
Done. Anyway, anyway.
Talk about sidetracking a segment.
Release the wiki.
Yeah, so, sure.
So, before we finish up, let's think of two open source celebrities.
Oh, really?
Not the two that we thought of earlier when we fluffed this section.
Come on, make Redmond do some work. You think of one.
Yeah, think of a celebrity.
Edward Hervey.
Oh. Who?
Edward Hervey.
Hervey.
No one's going to know who he is, though.
No, they're not going to know who he is. He's some kind of weird French distro.
Yeah.
Onion Eater Linux.
Mandriva.
Garlic.
Oh, Mandriva. Garlic Linux.
No one knows been at Mandriva.
Garlic.
Everyone at Florinda's currently pointing at him going, ah!
I know he's got a love of cheese, so maybe cheese.
He does. Cheese Eater Linux, will you?
Cheese eating
Surrender Monkey. Workshop
peasant. Pick a
Fromage Os.
Fromage Os.
That'd be Fromagix, the friend of Asterix. Get Asterix.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's
anyway, enough taking the piss out of the French.
We love you, Eddie. Remnant.
Okay, Chris de Bono.
Chris de Bono.
Mm.
He has a boner.
Mm. Is he the bloke who's just left
with
the flock?
He's,
No, that's Chris Messina. Chris de Bono's at Google.
He looks like the massive bloke from Penn and Teller.
He does.
He looks like... Oh, right.
Penn is the massive one.
The one who talks.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I suppose one who's actually good at magic.
He's really cool as Chris de Bono. I think he's very, very cool. I've seen him speak as well. He's a very good speaker. So, distro. Now, that's interesting.
Mm. Google Ubuntu, or whatever it's called.
Ubuntu.
The Ubuntu that never existed.
Bad.
there was a moment there, wasn't there? As your eyes met across the room.
I know nothing about this Ubuntu thing that I have never heard of.
Honest,
yes.
Bit.
Thank you and good night.
Chris de Bono.
Hello.
Chris de Bono, distribution.
You're looking at my bra.
Chris de Bono.
Mac OS X. Really, really, really secretive about everything.
I'd say Red Hat.
Why Red Hat?
Why?
Red Hat because
that's probably what
more kind of enterprisey, but does have an appreciation of the kind of the community sort of side of things. Because I think he does. I think he really does have an appreciation of the open source community, but is very much seated in Google as this kind of...
Okay.
You know, he understands business.
Lord High Business guy. Mm.
Maybe Susie, you know. That's kind of
Novell
thing.
Novell Linux Desktop.
Push off.
Yeah, Novell Linux Desktop. He's still doing that.
Sled.
Yeah, but it's Sled now. But
yeah. Sister Sled.
Yep.
Sled dog.
One more. Who's going to... Linus Torvalds.
What Mac OS X again.
Mac OS X. No.
No, it's so Minix, isn't it?
Minix, yeah.
Minix. Ken Browns just exploded.
I think Linux would be the GNU distribution. He hasn't got as far as compiling X yet because his kernel keeps crashing.
He's GNU Herd. Nice.
Herd.
The Herd. Herd Buntu, whatever.
The Herd.
The Herd. Right, let's wrap it up. P. Hey! Okay, on the show now, we've got the legendary Pia War. How are you doing, Pia?
I'm rocking, thank you very much.
Rocking.
Even at this time in the morning.
Yeah, what time is it where you are right now?
Oh, about 7:13 in the morning.
God.
What time was it when we rang her earlier?
yeah, we accidentally rung Pia about an hour ago, which was even earlier. Okay, tell us about Software Freedom Day.
Software Freedom Day is just had its third year. It's a global event where, I guess, not only the free software community, but also the broader freedom community, people that care about freedom generally, all get together to do some amazing events and get the public involved in why software freedom matters. And it's really cool because you end up having this celebration of the core values that underpin, you know, certainly our community, regardless of what distro you use or what software you use or whatever. It really is a way for everyone to come together to take this stuff out there. It's fantastic.
Cool,
excellent. Sorry for getting you up at O Dark 100 or whatever it is over there. Software Freedom Day, you said it's about, you know, getting the public involved, at least partially. Mm-hmm. How much of that has there actually been? I mean, when you pushed it out to the public in the past and this time and whatever, is the message actually getting out there, or is it kind of preaching to the converted, preaching to other free software people?
Well, what seems to happen, I mean, it really depends on the event that the teams run. So Software Freedom International, which is, I guess, the global group behind it, which is a group that sort of helps with messaging. It provides the single point of contact for everyone, and it helps the teams with running their events. But all the teams, you know, run events depending on what they want to do. So there are some teams that do very geek-oriented events where they might do install fest or you know, specific stuff for their lugs.
Cool.
But most of the teams do really go out of their way to involve broader events that are of interest to the public. So they might do a barbecue. They might do some talks. They might invite some journalists. They might invite some, you know, like at the event that I personally ran in Sydney, I actually had a politician, a journalist, a, you know, a culturalist, and someone who uses free software to help developing nations, you know, develop
capacity. Did you say a culturalist?
Yeah.
That sounds like a bullshit job.
Oh, look, hey, if you can get paid to get a name like that, look on. but yeah, so what we're finding is that there are a lot of people out in the broader public who are getting touched by this in some way or another, whether it be a pamphlet or actually coming along to an event. And what's really interesting is as the years are going by, more and more of the people that you just talk to on the street, they know what Linux is, which is awesome. Okay. They sort of understand, you know, open source a bit broader, and then talking to them about software freedom, particularly using e-voting as a mechanism for them to understand why
transparent
and sustainable systems is important. And then you just talk about, you know, Diebold in the US, and then you've got them caught. So people really are getting involved, and I think that we've probably, most teams hit somewhere between, you know, up to 500 to 1,000 people that they sort of see on their event.
Right.
And so there's, you know, up to probably 100,000 people around the world in the public that we're getting to every year. So.
Wow.
When I first heard about Software Freedom Day, I thought it was some kind of little sort of advocacy effort that not that many people were going to participate in. But from being a part of the Ubuntu community and from talking to a number of the Loco teams, a lot of people have participated in it. You know, and so how have you seen the interest kind of grow? Have you seen it kind of just take off beyond what you were expecting?
Me personally, I only heard about Software Freedom Day last year, and I actually got involved in the committee, the global board, after that event last year, and then I got elected president like 2 months ago or a month ago or so. So, it's only been running for 3 years. So we have over 200 teams happening in, you know, over 70 countries around the world.
Wow.
In the third year.
Fantastic.
So it's growing really, really, really fast. And I think that it's interesting to look at which regions that participate really strongly. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at sort of the Africa region, if you look at, Europe, there's a lot of participation. Australia and New Zealand has a lot of participation.
Yeah.
We're starting to see a lot more Asian teams come on now. And it's really great to sort of see where software freedom is really, really strong. Some countries like, you know, Nepal and Mongolia will have, you know, one team. In the US, you might have, you know, 20 teams or so. In Australia, you might have, say, 20 teams. It's, Right. It's really interesting to see the disbursement, but yeah, you know, over 200 teams this year, so we're really excited.
Wow. Cool. So, I mean, on the day that this goes out, it's about 10 days since Software Freedom Day 2006. Could you just run us down through some of the highlights that actually happened on this year's Software Freedom Day?
Okay, we're still getting a lot of the reports come in. A lot of people are still exhausted after, because it was only on the 16th, so it was only sort of 4 days away. A lot of people are still exhausted. In fact, I haven't even put the Sydney team report up yet. But what we're seeing is, I've actually got a whole bunch of the events up here. A lot of the events ran talks. There were workshops all around the place. A lot of people used, you know, the Elephant's Dream movie to sort of entice people to come in and check out this stuff, which was a big success, so that was great. There seems to be a movement away from, you know, just pamphlets, the pamphlet shotgun approach where you just go to the street and give out, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of pamphlets, but really to drawing people into events. There's some great stuff happening in Mongolia, some great stuff happening in Mexico. There was an event in New Zealand where they had a little girl in a penguin suit and just running around a mall, and they had a computer set up, and people would, you know, they'd see the penguin and say, oh, hello, little girl, how cute are you? And she'd say, go check out those people that give you free software. Wow. So, you know, there's all kinds of approaches, and there's great photos online at the moment. So if anyone does want to check out, I guess, what's been happening around the world and even in their region, go to softwarefreedomday.org/teamreports, capital T, capital R, and you'll see some of the reports are starting to come through, but there's not many coming through yet. I think people are still a bit exhausted.
Yeah.
Cool, excellent. I mean, a couple of things that you've mentioned there, the Diebold voting machine thing and Elephant's Dream and so on, they're things outside software. I mean, the Diebold voting machine is a perfect example of how you can say, yes, software gives you freedom. And it's a good hook that you can hang it on to actually convince the public. Do you think Linux and free software in general needs that kind of hook that exists outside what you'd think of as computers to get people interested in it?
So most of us, right, most of us who love this space and have gotten involved, we got involved because we started using it, right? At the first, we you know, as technical people or whatever, we started using it, came to love it, and then later down the track, we started to understand the broader, I guess, social freedom, all those kind of ramifications. I know that I certainly was using, in particular, Linux for probably 3 or 4 years before I got involved in the community and started going, holy shit, this is so much bigger and cooler than I thought.
Yeah.
But it's a really big ask for us to go to the public and to ask people to, you know, leapfrog those 5 or 6 years worth of, you know, understanding that we came to get to this point. So I think that taking those kinds of issues and taking issues that directly impact people today that they can understand is really important. Because we are asking a big thing for them to directly understand software freedom when most of us didn't understand it to start.
Yes.
The e-voting thing is really important. It was really funny. In Australia, I did an interview with one of the local youth radio stations. And in one state in Australia, they're doing e-voting with an open source product. And with another state, they're doing it with a proprietary product.
Right.
And I made the point that, you know, it's great for the government to be able to see the source code of the proprietary one, but we're voting, so we should be able to actually see the source code ourselves to be able to trust the results.
Mm-hmm.
And that really resonated. Like, they really got that. This is a mainstream, one of the most popular youth, I guess, radio stations in Australia. It's national. And that was the angle that they really understood and really took out of, you know, 20 minutes of interview. That was the 5 minutes that they used. So I think those issues are really important to understand because from our perspective, we understand the underpinning, I guess, reasons why this is how it affects us. But we need to be able to take that message to people generally.
Yeah. Cool, no, marvellous. One last question then. I mean, obviously people have missed the boat this year, but if people want to get involved in Software Freedom Day next year, when do they want to start getting involved and how do they do it?
The best thing to do is to go to the website, check out the start guide, which will give you, you know, the sort of things that, you know, you can do, that, you know, to open your mind to the what other teams are doing. Check out the reports of what this year did. There's a mailing list called team-contacts. Join that mailing list, and then what will happen is when the registration's open for next year, you'll hear about it, and that way you can get involved. Any teams that have not been listed on the registrations team that did participate this year, please let us know so that we can add you, because the full list is about 200 at the moment, but we know that there were more teams that were doing stuff out there. We had teams registering literally up to the day before, so... But if people register during the registration period, which will be announced on Team Contact, we'll be able to send them goodies. So CDs and T-shirts and balloons and all the great colourful stuff to help make it a great day.
Fantastic. Marvellous. Thanks very much for talking to us. Yeah. You and the rest of the Software Freedom Day teams are doing a great job.
Yes.
Thanks
definitely.
Very much, Pia, and we'll talk to you soon.
No problem.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, one more last thing.
Yep. Yep.
I want people out there to remember that software freedom is not just for geeks, so we've got to get it out there.
Yes.
Nice
Sing
one, Pia.
Sister.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Take
Bye.
Care.
Goodbye.
Bye. Make time or fuck off.
Nice.
So that's the statement, right?
Yeah.
Make time or fuck off. Is that a reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, debate.
We should clarify a little bit what we mean. You should make time to contribute to the community or fuck off and stop complaining.
Yeah. So what do we think? Anyone want to start off the proceedings?
Is anyone bold enough to say they believe that?
No, I don't think I believe that.
I don't believe that either.
No. I can see why we've chosen to do this segment.
This arises from a conversation that Scott and I were having not more than 15 minutes ago, where Scott and I were, Scott was saying that if you really want to be part of the community and you really want to contribute, you will find time. And I said that with a very demanding day job, a pregnant wife and a house to decorate, I would love to contribute more, but I find it very difficult to find the time, and I do have to sleep and commute at some point.
Now, I'd like to counter that slightly, because I don't believe in make time or fuck off, because I don't think that's kind of like binary, it's one or the other, essentially.
Yes.
I believe that there's somewhere in between, but there's a certain argument for if you like something enough, right, then you'll just make time for it. And as Scott said, sometimes people ruin their lives and their marriages and all the rest of it because they make a bit too much time. So do we believe that, I mean, because I'd say to an extent that, like you mentioned the decorating, I can understand you've got a pregnant wife, not just using you as an example, but in other things. For me personally, if I had a pregnant wife and those similar responsibilities, I'd probably sack off the decorating a little bit.
Well,
and kind of, I'd kind of deprive those duties a little bit more. I wouldn't deprive my pregnant wife, but I'd deprive something like that, if you know what
well,
I mean.
Well, it ought to be pointed out that this room is an absolute pit of shite. So it's clearly obvious that sitting in a nice, comfortable, clean, pretty environment is not high on your list of priorities.
Absolutely. That's an exaggeration.
But imagine instead of saying, Matt saying he needs to do the decorating, your thing is sack off the band.
Yeah.
Would you say, well, you know, I've got time for both of them, so sack off the band.
No.
Or would you say, no, I want to try and fit them all
no,
in?
No, you're twisting my words. That's exactly my point. My point is that you look at things and you determine how important they are. So, for example, some people who are really into decorating would think, well, that is
not really in the decorating. No, I'm not, an old lady's house.
I'm not using you as an example. I'm just saying that some people will be really into decorating, and that's their hobby, and they'll prioritise that.
All right, but the reason that I thought this was an interesting discussion, or at least that I wanted to take part in it, I'm not saying that I suggested the segment, was that the feeling I got from Scott, whether rightly or wrongly, was that if you weren't prepared to make time, then somehow you weren't committed enough. And I kind of prickled a little at that, because I mean, the most I can do at the moment is post your story to the fridge. I'd love to do more.
Well, actually, you say you've got a pregnant wife, you've got to do the decorating, you've got to cook, you've got to do all the kind of normal homemaker stuff. Yet, you still find time every few weeks to sort of pop over and spend an entire evening recording a Let's Advocacy radio show. You still manage to be
Does Lug Radio not count as a contribution?
It does count as a contribution in my mind.
But then you're really making time. My point is I can't now contribute to the Ubuntu marketing team in the way I want.
But you're contributing in more the ways than one to the whole community. We were talking about the people who never actually managed to get to the first. What we were actually talking about was sort of the people who, in projects, kind of get to the point where they're all ready to go. They join all the mailing lists. They get on the websites and stuff like that. And then they find that they haven't actually. There's no motivation there, or there's some thing missing. They don't actually jump in. You know, the people who sort of, well, they walk around the swimming pool and don't actually get in the pool in the sort of way.
Right.
So it's the only sort of metaphor I can think of for it. The actual conversation I was sort of thinking of was, you know, why do these people not kind of join in? Why do people sort of sit, read the wiki and kind of like read the web mailing lists and stuff, but don't really actually ever get round to contribute? Well, that is entirely valid.
Massively overextend the analogy.
Maybe the environment we create isn't welcoming enough.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we could ask somebody who's well respected in the community for fostering new community development and so on. I mean, is this a problem in the communities themselves? I mean, is this something that, you know, is the water too cold? I mean, are we do communities actively put off? I mean, an example I can think of here is I've been reading the GNOME mailing list and following GNOME releases and compiling it for years, yet I've not contributed a single piece of source code to GNOME. Why is that? Why have I not taken that leap to actually, you know, filing it? You know, I could go into the Bugzilla, I could go find a bug, I'm sure I probably could patch it and fix it. Why is it I've never actually done that on GNOME?
I mean, I'd say that the reason for that, I think there's, you take two, I think a potential contributor takes two things into account. The first of all, take into account whether that community is right for them to contribute to. Now, that will be a certain element of, they're interested in enough in that community, be it GNOME or Ubuntu Marketing, as in Matt's example, that they want to contribute to that particular thing. So for you personally, it probably just didn't tickle you as much as doing other stuff. It's probably not as important to you as maybe doing kernel stuff or you know, making, you know, technologies that appear once every 30 years in Unix. But then the other thing I'd say, going back to the previous point, was whether you prioritise the task of getting involved over other things. That's essentially part of it, because I think certain people in the community, some people, as we've said, will basically sacrifice anything.
Yep,
they'll sacrifice anything. Yet for some people, there's always something else to do. It's like, it's as if it's homework. There's always something better that they can do. And then you've got most people in the middle, you know.
I think there's something you're missing. And the best example I can come up with is when you've got meetings at work. Right. If you've got someone up front presenting, and you've got a batch of people who are watching the presentation, and occasionally the presenter will turn to the audience and say, "So, has anyone got any questions?" Or they'll say, "Can someone give me an example of this?" Nobody says anything, ever. Everyone kind of looks down and doesn't make eye contact because they don't want to speak up. Occasionally, you get people who do speak up.
Because they're intimidated.
Absolutely. I mean, largely, I would say
it's too cold.
The people in this room are. The sort of people who will speak up, because they're not necessarily afraid of just doing a thing in public. It's possibly that the thing's too intimidating, but it's not intimidating to ask a question. If the presenter went to each one individually and said, "Have you got any questions?" Everyone could probably think of and would think of a question. It's just standing up and doing something in front of other people.
No, I disagree. I think it's intimidating for people to ask a question. I mean, as an example, there's people who have come into the Jikoshi community and contributed as developers, and they've, you know, they've been learning GStreamer, and they've had questions about GStreamer, but they don't feel comfortable asking questions to the GStreamer people. And they could contact them privately, or it's over the internet, or whatever. So it's the actual, I think part of it is the issue of, they don't want to seem stupid in front of people who, you know, who are their peers. So I think there is some of that. In that example of the room, I'm with Aidan, you know, people feel intimidated for talking in front of people. I think some people just feel intimidated with looking stupid.
I think also
there's some people who didn't come to Lug Radio Live because they didn't know anything about Linux.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
But
yeah.
Let's take a bug tracking system, for example. So,
Are you speaking to mind?
Malone.
I was just thinking of GNOME, in general, where I could, if I wanted, invest effort of my own time, which I'm detracting from my social life, my partner, my sort of ongoing decorating. bathroom really needs doing.
Harsh to the map, by
the way. My bathroom is a cave at the moment.
You should see my bathroom, actually.
My bathroom is
terrible.
Really, really, really nice.
You can decorate mine.
No, I can't.
So,
in my day, you didn't have bathrooms.
So I've got to take some of this time out and invest that instead in, say, going through the GNOME Bugzilla, looking at a couple of packages that I use every day, and actually kind of looking at some of the bugs, triaging them myself as the, you know, and figuring out what's wrong with them, writing a patch to fix them, putting the patch back into Bugzilla. And I think a lot of us won't actually extend that effort unless we think our patch is going to get accepted.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the communities... and I think this is true of most open source communities at the moment, right down from the smallest projects. You know, I'm quite concerned about this, having got a little project which is kind of starting off, and I've got to try and build a budding community for this. But I also think this is all true to the biggest ones. Even Ubuntu, even GNOME, even Debian all have this problem where for somebody who wants to invest some time in it, until they actually think that time is going to be a well invested, they're not actually willing to kind of invest that time.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like they need to get something out of it, even if it's just getting that patch in. They've got to achieve something.
Part of your problem there, though, is if you say, well, I'm going to contribute a patch to Mozilla. I'm going to have a look through the thing, and I can patch this. I could do a bit of C code. And you write a bit of C code, and then the first response is, that's not how we write patches. And, yes. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that people should be more welcoming, but they've got project standards and stuff like that. But in order to do your first tiny patch, where you just have to change one line of code and change the number in it from a 1 to a 2, you have to understand the whole project and the whole way it fits yep. together and everything.
But that's...
I don't know how you can... I don't know how that's a fixable thing, though. But it does make... It makes it really difficult to fix the first bug. Fixing the second one's dead easy.
Taking a step back from that,
it's not just patches either.
What if you don't know anything about coding? Should you just stop using Mozilla? Are you not allowed? If you can't contribute, should you just fuck off?
That there was are the loads of contribute
that
aren't
That
code.
Was the segment.
But being a user is a contribution, isn't it? Mm.
Is it?
No.
You don't think so?
No. Being a user isn't a contribution. Being a user and occasionally helping someone out if they ask a question, or advocating Mozilla, or looking at forums, or writing documentation, or just telling your friend about it, yeah. or whatever, that's contributing. Just using something is not a contribution.
Yeah.
So they should fuck off, right?
No, you see,
going back to the original statement just quickly, it was make time or fuck off, and you said, and we said, does anyone agree with that? Everyone went, no.
Sweetie must have agreed with it.
Me.
Why?
I would modify it a bit to make time to contribute or fuck off, stop complaining. I think that's fine. If you want to use the thing and you don't want to make any time to be involved, that's fine. But I think to some extent, at least, you forfeit your right to piss and moan about it if you could help fix it and don't do so.
Is that the if you don't vote, you can't complain about the government that elected?
Yeah,
well, I think that's fair. But then you hit on an important point here is if you could fix it. And part of the issue here is, I mean, there's people out there who are perfectly capable of fixing it. Now, the term fix it in most scenarios involves coding. Right?
Mm.
There are other, obviously there's packaging and things like that.
Translations.
In translations,
there's artwork. There's even sometimes by, you know, if let's say like Firefox and stuff, sometimes even just being a user and reporting the pages that don't render
exactly.
correctly in Firefox yeah. is but, a massive
but,
contribution.
But I'd say in most projects, most people typically refer to something that's broken as it's there's a bug in it which can be fixed with code. Now, I'd say that there's a lot of people out there who are capable of fixing those bugs, but either don't feel that they have the chops to do it because they're so overwhelmed by the project. And imagine, I mean, I think it's bad enough for people who join a smaller project like Jocosha, but can you imagine what it must be like for OpenOffice?
Yeah.
That's used by, like, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people around the world, you know. So, I can imagine it really is quite intimidating. The point you made earlier on about how do you kind of solve this issue of this thing's so overwhelming, how do you get people involved? That's something I've thought about recently a lot with Jocosha, because it's getting to a point now where it's a reasonable sized code base. You need to know quite a lot about the quirks about how things work to get on with it.
So have you documented those quirks anywhere?
Well, this is the point, is that I was thinking to myself the other day, how are we going to get people involved in Jocosha? Because we've got a very, very small team, right? And I was thinking, you know, what we need to do is we need to encourage these projects to open out more and explain how these things work. So, for example, the one thing I was working on the other day was doing screencasts. I was going to do a screencast showing you going for a walk through the Jocosha code and explaining how it works, because it's much easier for me to explain it talking than writing a bloody how-to. Because if I'm a contributor and I look and I want to contribute to Jocosha, I don't want to read 2,000 words of techno-babble before I can write a patch.
Mm.
Whereas it's much more enjoyable, much better for me to just sit there and watch a screencast, and then it feels more personal and all the rest of it. So I think little things like that, just explain, like we had a comments day, we had a code cleanup day, where we just spent the entire day filling the code with comments. And that's going to help people get involved, you know, things like that. So I think, the only other thing which we've done is how we have bite-sized bug reports. Bug reports that are simple fixes. We mark them as bite-sized. So if someone joins the project and they want to get started, we say, try one of the bite-sized bug reports, because then they can contribute and they get an instant win, like you were saying.
So, just out of interest, let's say they kind of take one of those bite-sized bug reports and they kind of put it all together and they get it fixed and stuff. How would they, you know, how do they contribute the fix back? How do they kind of make the fix back show up enough that they think that it's rewarding to them to have done it?
The way we do it in Jocosha is that we've got on the wiki, we've got some documentation that basically says, you know, how you contribute a fix back. And you basically send in, at the moment, it's like two patches. If you send a couple of patches in, so you send in your first one, send it to the mailing list, we'll apply it, we'll give you lots of positive feedback if it's good and, you know, and constructive if it's not so good. And then once you've had a couple applied, we then give you a Subversion account. Mm. So people earn their accounts, but
it means that they at least get some constructive feedback. And I believe every single person who's contributed a patch, which is not that many people, have had really positive feedback.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, a point that Aidan and Matt have both made in the past, because neither of them are particularly coders. There's kind
of a time rich.
No, there's kind of a barter system almost. I mean, you don't necessarily forfeit your right to piss and moan about a bug unless you try and fix that bug. But you can kind of say, I can't try and fix this bug, but I did do this other thing for the community. So you sort of trade the two off.
Like,
so I'm a valuable contributor to the community in other ways. Maybe people will reward me for my contribution by fixing the bug that really pisses me off in Mozilla. And it's something Matt said quite a lot in the past, I think, about the idea of getting into the community in other ways and then getting
paid. So you're getting back to the bit that you should at least contribute something.
Yes.
Or stop using it.
But this is the
thing. Not stop using it. Stop complaining about it.
But I think...
Stop complaining unconstructively. Because if you complain in a good way, then I suppose you're
complaining
contributing,
Complaining in a good way is contribution. Yeah, it's a difficult, you know...
Because, I mean, take a good example of this is Adam Sweet. Adam Sweet has always considered himself as somebody who doesn't really have an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount to contribute to a project. And he's helped out with Jacosha, and he's just been testing and giving good feedback. And that's a real contribution in any project, you know. Yeah. Testing, giving good feedback, particularly on smaller projects where they don't have that many people using it. You know, so little things like that. But just twisting back a little bit, the original question was, do people who say they haven't got enough time, have they actually got the ability to make time? That's the question.
That's on an individual basis, isn't it?
It is on an individual basis. But just, I mean, let's go around and summarise what we think about that statement. Do people have the ability to make time, even if they say that they've got...
Well, obviously, Matt and I are going to say no.
Yep, okay, and why do you think, you know...
I'll speak for myself.
See, this isn't the point. The point is that, obviously, what Ack says is that, you know, if you forfeit your right to complain, but that's not the impression that you get. When you're someone who doesn't have the time to contribute to the community, the impression you get is, make time or fuck off.
Right, okay.
It's not make time or stop complaining. That's not the impression you get.
Yeah.
I think the...
But you get the impression... Do you really get the impression of make time or fuck off?
Yeah. Totally.
I think it's
a real shame.
Unfortunately, I actually agree with Aid here. I think the impression a lot of the communities do actually give is make time or fuck off.
Mm.
I think a lot of them... won't even value sometimes your input on things unless you've made time, sometimes even just to that project as well, which is somewhat sad.
Mm.
I think this is something that I think a lot of communities need to address in themselves.
Yeah.
Mm. I think a lot of the communities actually do need to kind of start realizing that, you know, you've got to be able to not only aid sort of people in making time in a way, but also making it so they, you know, they don't need to make as much time perhaps. And also, to be honest with you, quite just valuing the contribution of somebody there sitting there using it every day.
Yeah.
I mean, some really stupid examples here. Someone sitting there using it every day, a valuable contribution, let's take GNOME, would be to have a little option there, send in a screencast of how they use it every day, which to a user interface developer is a great contribution because it shows them which buttons they're pushing and which ones need to be made bigger, where they're going wrong, where they're having problems with the interface, where they're doing something the designer didn't expect. So that, you know, the GNOME community is kind of, I'm unfairly picking on them because it's the only one I've had kind of dealings with in the sort of I haven't felt like I've been able to contribute to it kind of side. I would say that, you know, where a community is currently saying sort of make time or fuck off, I think the community actually needs to kind of look is there any way they can actually make it easier for people to contribute things that they are able to with the time they have?
I was going
to
say, because part of it, I mean, again, using Matt as an example, I believe that Matt legitimately doesn't have enough time.
Knowing him. Really?
But I'm assuming that, like, tonight we're recording Lug Radio, and Matt's deliberately made time. I'm assuming you fit all the other shit in around this, so you can keep doing this. But what I was going to say was, I'm sure that there'll be times when you might have, let's say, an hour on an evening where you haven't really got anything to do, and you think, I'd like to contribute something.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last thing you want to be doing is spending that hour pissing around with stuff. You want to get stuff done, don't you?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, I regularly will have an hour or even two of an evening where I have a laptop on my lap.
Oh my god!
I could be watching TV or something at the
same time. Do you have any clothes on?
Generally, but I might have a duvet instead.
Generally.
One of the things that is difficult from my point of view, and has been over the time that I've been into free software, is knowing where I can contribute and actually getting that in point. So, for example, I hate to bring it up again. The Ubuntu marketing team, right?
No, that's cool.
When I first wanted to get involved in that, it was very difficult because basically there was one, as I've mentioned before, one lone guy who who wanted to be in charge and all this sort of stuff. And being able to get around him as a massive barrier was enough of an effort in itself.
Right.
And, yeah, okay, I eventually got around it. But I imagine that there was a lot for other people who have similar situations in different communities where to even just start contributing when they're not as technical as a hacker or whatever, it is just a major barrier in itself, just knowing where you can contribute. And I think
and invariably
part of the answer...
I was going to say, invariably, having influence in that community requires more hours.
I don't know, what do you think, Mr. Bradshaw?
Just finish the point. My suggestion of how to combat that is that we need really, really good project websites where you have a how can I contribute sort of button. And it makes it fairly obvious up front that for non-technical people, you can do these things. And you should have also named people, and I appreciate, I mean, Scott was telling us earlier how much email he gets as a known person within the community. But it would be great if there was some way that you could have almost mentors within the community who new people could kind of find on IRC, or not even IRC, because that's even too strange a medium for some people, maybe some other way, such as email, to just say, look, I really want to do this, and I've really tried hard to find it in the wiki where I can maybe document this bit or whatever. Yeah. Can you help me?
No, I agree.
But I mean, the possible difference there is Matt will say, you know, I found an hour or two and I thought, I got a spare hour. I'd like to contribute something to the community, but I can't find anything to do. Do you often find yourself with an hour and find yourself wanting to contribute and not knowing where? Or
see, all of this is based around aiding people making a contribution, right? What if you just can't? Should you just go?
What do you mean, can't?
Well, if you just can't. Well, if you don't have the ability, you don't have the time, you don't have the ability, expertise.
There's a different thing between time and ability.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
I do not believe there is anybody out there who is not capable of making
exactly.
A contribution.
So what you're saying is they absolutely have to.
Well,
no. Because they can all do something.
Well, of course
and
they
if
don't.
If they don't do something,
they don't.
Then you're the lazy
shit. I don't think we should have an expectation on our users to contribute.
Every single user contribute.
But I'd say that we should encourage contribution. Every single user out there has the ability to contribute something.
And is therefore expected to.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that we shouldn't expect our users to, we should encourage them to.
Right.
We should create an environment in which they feel it's rewarding to do so.
Because if we expect people to do it, and that's, like, mandated, no one will use the software if they don't want to contribute. Most people out there don't have it in, you know, there's just not something in their brain which makes them think, I know what I'm going to do with my hour tonight when I'm not at work. I'm going to sit on the internet and contribute to free software. I'd say that a reasonable proportion of people don't have that in them, but we can encourage that in those people.
I think part of it is... You want to discourage the idea that you have to go, now you should make a contribution. I suspect a lot of people out there, the ordinary users you're talking about, who don't necessarily think they can make a contribution, something they're already doing could be that.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
It's not like they have to make a special effort. I mean, take your wiki as an example.
I was
going to
say, your wiki is perfect.
Your wiki is an absolutely perfect
Didn't
example.
Didn't see that coming to mind.
No, I mean, this is not designed to have a pop at you. The point is, I haven't said, hey, you should make a contribution by documenting all the stuff that you do and making it available. You've already done that. It's no extra effort to make that a contribution. So you already do have the ability and have proved that as a point.
But you're a good example, though, because you're very, very technically capable, you're very socially capable, and your wiki is this great resource. I mean, Aid was flicking through it earlier on, showing us this wiki, right? And Aid's got these scraps of information, but that could be enormously helpful to people. But I think you think to yourself, well, it's not really a contribution, it's not really going to help people. But even if you help one person...
It's about 1,000 post-it notes stuck on a wall.
Yeah, it is. But imagine one person looks at one of those post-it notes and thinks, wow, that really helped me out. As is the case, you know, I'd say 10 years ago, it wasn't the case when we didn't have Google and things like that, but...
So your argument is everyone's got a contribution in them, and therefore they must make it.
No, I keep saying it's not they've got to. I'm saying it should be encouraged, but everyone has the ability to contribute, but it should be encouraged.
I do actually agree that everyone has the ability to contribute something. It's contribution can be a very... loose thing. I mean, you contribute this show to the world, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And So everyone does have the ability in them to contribute something. Someone could contribute screenshots of what they do. Someone can contribute code. Someone can contribute artwork. Someone could contribute stories or someone
blog
could contribute
entries,
getting their sister also using Linux. There's a lot of things everyone kind of has to contribute. I think also that projects need to make it easier for people to do these contributions. I think they need to make it possible for everyone to contribute in all the ways that they are able to.
Mm.
Do I think everyone has to contribute? It's a difficult question. I mean,
it's almost guiltware at this point, though, isn't it?
I mean, it's one of the things I've...
I see your point.
Tangenting slightly, I mean, one of the things I've kind of had moral wranglings about for a long time was when I first went to Australia, discovering that everybody there has to vote. It's compulsory.
Right.
And that's not true in Britain. So, you know, I don't know how often people are
if
reading around the world.
Happens,
but
by the way.
In America, if you, sorry, America? Sorry, sorry to all our Australian friends.
Cool.
In Australia, if everybody, I think, believe you get fined if you don't vote, equivalent to in England if you only don't register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, it's very much kind of difference. And I've had kind of long-running moral wranglings in my head, whether which one is actually right. I mean, in England we have very low vote turnouts. In Australia they have almost 100%. They are forcing a contribution from every single citizen to vote for their government. Is that right or is that wrong? I think it's a very difficult
question. Analogy, because it's basically exactly the same sort of thing, isn't it?
Although,
can you force people to have a political opinion about something?
So long as you've got a none of the above Bruce's Million option,
right? Yeah.
Then I suppose the Australia situation is fine. But I'm not sure how you have a none of the above option.
I don't know if we should have asked Pia when she was on the phone.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah,
you can see why people just might consider not using it because they can't make a contribution.
Not using software.
Yeah.
You see, I'd be surprised if people thought, I can't contribute to this software, therefore I'm not going
to
use it.
Or I'm made to feel.
I think if people are made to feel, that's completely wrong.
Well,
but like I say,
yeah,
people should be...
we're all going to say that, but...
No, I work with communities every day, and I believe that people should not be forced to make contributions.
Do you think it's the case throughout the free software community, or do you think there are just particular projects that do it more than others?
Yeah.
I don't think it's particular projects. I think it's just in general.
I think it's the job of people like us, the more, let's say, public-facing type people in the free software world, to almost shield the world from the kind of people who would turn it into guiltware, as you call it. And then, you know, we need to ease new people who want to contribute into the community so that they don't get the guilt trip and the idea that they're not worth listening to. And I it goes back to a lot of it just basically making websites a lot easier making websites a lot more effective in putting across how you can contribute, because it's not easy to find out on a lot of projects' websites.
But it's about communities also thinking getting new people, isn't it? It's basically marketing, like you say. So
yeah, and advocacy of the benefits of contributing. You're stopping the segment there, it seems, by slapping your knee.
Here it comes. Are you ready?
When your computer boots up, if it's using Linux or maybe Unix or one of those things...
At least Ubuntu.
Yeah, at least Ubuntu.
And only Ubuntu, man.
No, hang on.
Hang on, what about Solaris?
Yeah, or any kind of basically one of them things. What happens is it runs through a list of things that it wants to switch on, and it basically switches them on if it can.
Starts.
And then when you shut down, it runs through a list of things and shuts them down.
Matthew,
is basically what happens.
Does it find those in autoexec.bat?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, right.
Surprisingly.
That brings back the memes.
And there's no config.sys either.
What?
It goes through something which I don't fully understand, but
it's
Scott
a bit
James
like
autoexec.bat has revolutionised.
Yes.
So, Scott, tell us.
It is a revolution.
This thing called Upstart, right? It's got a funky logo, and lots of people are excited about it.
God
what the hell is
Upstart?
It?
What it is, for anyone who's used sort of Windows, it's that little pretty user interface which lets you start and stop all of the Windows services. For anyone who's used macOS, it's Launchd. For anyone who's kind of using anything else, it's the program that sits on your computer, runs all the time, starts everything that needs to be started, stops everything that needs to be stopped, and kind of is a much more modern, updated version of that kind of thing, sort of written for what we need today rather than lots of
So what
ago.
Used to do that?
Right.
In it.
I was going to say, isn't that in it?
In it, right. Wicked light.
In it, man. In it. In it is a process which has been sort of, it's the Unix process number one. You'll see it at the top of top PS every time you look at it. And the version we use at the moment, was based on the AT&T System 5, which is about 30 years old.
So this will be why your proposed replacement is
actual replacement
is, well, yeah, actual replacement, Synergy is is one of the biggest innovations in 30 years of Unix.
I just want to bring
something back. So what you've done really is you've completely started something from scratch, throwing away the 30-year-old stuff.
We didn't actually...
A gets a victory on the throwing something away and starting again.
That's actually completely true. I mean, we used initially a lot of the code from the old System 5 init process. And what we found was, as we kind of wrote it, the code just went away. We had better ways of doing it and stuff. So we never actually started from scratch. The design is... We're pretty much sort of from scratch from that point of view. It's completely different to the design of the current, the older one.
Okay.
But the design is a lot more inspired by what everyone else is kind of thinking about and sort of what everyone else needs at the moment.
What's process one then now?
It's still called init, but it's now a completely new program.
So why, what practical advantages does this have for the ordinary Linux user?
So, if it's successful, the ordinary Linux user doesn't care. It's sufficiently low level. Where this fits in, so let's sort of say you've got Dbus now, which is doing the message passing. The ordinary user doesn't care about that. But what it for them means, it means that when your network comes up and goes down, that can be communicated to your your screensaver or button. Why would you communicate your power manage when you've gone to battery power? It can be communicated to your screensaver and tell it to turn off rather than waste power displaying pictures of bouncing cows. So that's what Dbus gives the ordinary user. It's a message passing system. HAL is a program for dealing with abstracting hardware. For the ordinary user, that just means that they can have something which can actually detect the battery level and things like that. What Upstart does for the ordinary Linux user is mean that when they plug in a USB hard drive, it can be, the message comes from HAL going over Dbus telling it's been mounted, which means Upstart can respond to that message and start something that hard drive needs.
Would init have done that?
Init can't do that currently.
Oh.
That's what init cannot do. What we have
so
at the moment
is... So what does it now? Because I put my USB pen in it.
So what happens is HAL starts up a bunch of little programs, and it has to manage those, and it has to have the code to manage those.
Right.
But then, let's say when you unplug your battery, a different program at the moment goes off and does that.
Right.
Oh.
That comes from ACPD or GNOME Power Manager is sort of sliding towards.
Right.
But a different program goes off and when you pull that out. And when you, let's say when your network comes up, if you want, say, your computer's date to be synchronized or your, file systems, network file systems.
What's
time
protocol would that use?
Ah, NTP.
You've got a Woody there.
Thank you.
He has actually got the bone. I got a Woody on the trail.
But you need different code then to start those up and stuff.
Sure.
What Upstart does is moves all that into just the one place in the init process where it belongs. So when you get the battery gets plugged in or unplugged, you get the message across which Upstart can respond to and start and stop services.
Okay.
When you get the network comes up, Upstart can respond to that and say start Apache because you're on the network, start the DNS server because you're on the network.
Okay.
It can stop it when the network goes down again. It can reduce the limit, your resources and stuff like that your computer's used. You can even go to the degree where you can say that you're only going to run Apache while the wire is plugged in. Don't run Apache while you're on the wireless interface.
Yeah.
You can do things like that's the idea. It brings service management to one level where everything is configured in the same place.
Is there a GUI for this?
There will be a GUI for this. Right.
It is much more kind of. It does fit in with a lot more with kind of desktops in many ways, where things are kind of where things are unplugged and plugged from computers, because that obviously doesn't happen so much with servers.
Yeah, aid your servers. How often do they switch from being wired to wireless and then back again?
That would be never.
On the other side, on the server side, this is kind of uninteresting because you have init can do the job, and Upstart can do the same job as init. It can start all your scripts, mount your hard drives and stuff. Where it helps is obviously you have RAID arrays and stuff which take more time to initialize.
Yeah.
You may actually find there are sort of problems with the current boot sequence where things don't happen in the right order because, it's an autoexec.bat. It is a long list of one code. It's just separated into multiple files. Where Upstart comes in and useful is it can actually order, when the RAID comes up, it can check the file system and do that.
Right.
It doesn't work in one long sequence. It works by a series of events.
Yeah. I have two questions, which I'd like
I've got two questions.
We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, so...
I'll answer them quickly.
Answer them quickly. My two questions are, one, How is Upstart different from other next generation init replacements like init?
Right. that'd be init right. engine init or
so
minute
to answer the first question very quickly, the principal difference is Upstart works on events. It works on a Dbus message has been received, so the network has come up, so start the network.
Right.
Existing ones work on the idea of dependencies where they only focus on booting the system and kind of stuff like they say GDM needs networking, so if you need to start GDM, start networking. We work on the other way around, where it says when a network card gets plugged in, you have to start.
Stuff happens.
Stuff happens. That's the principal difference.
Okay.
Question number two is, although everyone should be using Edge, obviously, how are other distros reacting to this? Are they going to include it as well?
I'm hoping so. I mean, when we developed this, I mean, it's not, well, I say we developed, it's pretty much myself and sort of some other people designed. When we first started out, we sent them all the documents and stuff. We kind of tried to get them interested. We've had sort of some support. We've had some people come and ask questions. I'm trying to still very much try and be inclusive with them. I'm trying to kind of promote the idea that anybody from Fedora, from Gentoo, from everyone else can help with the design. So we're still in the process of writing this. I mean, it's in Edgy, but we have sort of more things we want to do with this.
But you've developed it all out in the open, haven't
we
you?
We have developed it completely in the open. The specifications for it were open.
Other big boys to
you know, the covers in it. And I really want these other people. I think at the moment there's a nervousness. They want to see it running first, I think.
Yeah.
It's very much true. Right. And I'm hoping once Edgy's out there and showing that this thing actually does work, that we'll actually get
some
more
people.
Will it
speed my boot up any quicker?
Initially, right now, Edgy boots only slightly faster due to other changes. Yes, in the long run, but that's not its goal.
Right.
Well, the shutdown's quicker, isn't it?
Shutdown is quicker for other reasons again. But in the long run,
isn't it? Lightning fast is shutdown. I've noticed that recently.
What's the advantage to Ubuntu to take this initiative?
Why did we do it? We want everything to just work, and we found that we were increasingly dealing with race conditions, which is when you have two things trying to compete for the same resource or trying to which one first kind of is random. And we have lots of things where, you know, you can't right now have a USB hard drive with your home directory on it because the boot system will reach the point where it mounts the home directory before it reaches the point where it does that. With a lot of these kind of things, we just want to be able to do. We want everything to just work. We want the users to put their stuff in and it just worked. That's why we invested in this.
You had two questions and then we'll wrap it.
I did have two questions, which are actually on sort of similar subjects to Jono's, but a different angle.
Yep.
The first one is, the way this is being talked about and the benefits it brings sound very much like the way Apple pushed launch services, Launchd, when they released it.
Does
a similar kind of job in a similar kind of way with similar kinds of benefits.
Yes,
so why are we using Upstart rather than Launchd?
That's because Apple didn't open source it.
I thought Apple did. That's the question. If your answer is it's proprietary or it's APSL, then fine, I'll shut up.
So one of our things, going back to something else John touched on very briefly, was we do want every other distribution to be using this. We do think we've got the right solution here. We think it's going to be an integral part of the Linux desktop. We think it's going to be Dbus and HAL level. You know, it's going to be alongside those. A lot of distributions, why aren't distributions using Launchd today? Because it's APSL or because it was CDDL beforehand.
It is APSL, is it? I thought they'd actually opened it. It was APSL version 2. You could integrate it. You can put it into things.
So the license was continuous under Flux. Nobody used it. And at the time we started developing this, the license was very definitely bad.
Right, okay.
We might have actually extended it at the time, but by the time the license was renewed, we'd already got this.
Yep, okay. And one more very, very quick question. Does this not mean that you have to rewrite the whole world to talk to Upstart? And is that not a massive task?
Not many things talk to init today because it's so draconian there's no way to talk to it. I don't think you don't have to rewrite anything. You can start developing
support.
So
people will start adding support to Upstart because they can do that where they couldn't do it before.
And you've got Upstart dash compat as well, haven't you?
At the moment it can run the existing. You don't have to change a single init script to try it out today. It will just run.
So how could a member who had the time contribute?
Yeah, how can people get involved?
Go to Upstart, upstart.ubuntu.com, and you'll find the website which gives you links to the mailing list.
Fantastic.
Please join the mailing list.
Sounds awesome.
Please, there is links to all the documents we've used to design this thing. There is the bug tracking system there. There is the code. You can grab the code. You can actually start committing straight away on your own branches with it. You know, you don't need to commit access. You can give your own branches and publish those.
Cool.
And, please join in.
Can you currently
help.
Run it on anything other than Edgy?
You can run it on anything you like. Anything that
can you run it on anything other than Edgy without doing tons and tons and tons of work to fuck up your boot process?
You can install it on Debian today. I believe these packages are experimental. So.
Cool. And the next time you see Scott at the conference, go up to him and shake his hand because he is now in the Hall of Fame of Unix legends for this 30-year-old, you know, innovation in Unix.
Being killed.
Fantastic. Avast.
'Tis the end of the show. Yes, it's actually Talk Like a Pirate Day as we record, but not as you listen. Anyway, it's the end of the show. Time for some emails.
Very nice.
Summer of Code, writes Tim Clark. Do you remember the segment we did?
Since
you were talking about Summer of Code-style projects, I thought I'd write in with my own suggestion. I'm starting university in a couple of weeks, and I could really use some note-taking software to use with my graphics tablet.
His Grablet.
His Grablet, yeah. My Windows-using friends all have Microsoft OneNote, but I haven't been able to find a suitable open-source equivalent.
Kind of now, rich uni disease.
What is OneNote anyway?
When you were at Microsoft.
I still don't know what it is.
That's interesting for two reasons. First of all, there's a thing called Zournal, X-O-U-R-N-A-L.
Okay.
And secondly, I don't know whether tablet PCs have suddenly hit the mainstream or what, but I keep seeing loads of people saying, how do I get tablet stuff working on Linux?
That's because it's a big gap, isn't
there? I haven't
seen anyone. I mean, it is. obviously, I'm reading different places. tabletpc.com or anything.
I mean, a couple of years ago, I was working for schools, and they were adopting tablet PCs. These were like junior schools.
Yeah, and then
like classroom in the future type places.
At the time, I thought there was nothing in the Linux world that would.
There is not very much.
Yeah.
It's certainly getting. I mean, this Zornal thing seems to be when people say I want.
Don't suppose you've got a URL for Tim Clark.
I haven't, but to be honest, if you Google for XOURNAL, there can't be that many sites to mention on to do with it.
There's half the problem there. Why I couldn't find it. Zornal, and
it's just random letters.
Well, yeah, but
sounds like a death metal band.
But then again, if I was sitting there thinking, right, I've got a tablet PC, I need to take notes, what should I Google for? The word OneNote doesn't immediately pop into my brain.
But it does to people who use Windows.
No, it doesn't.
If
I gave you a tablet PC with Windows on it and no copy of OneNote, and I said, do you find a piece of software that does it? You wouldn't think, I must Google for the word OneNote.
But also, if you gave me a piece of unrecognisable meat and asked me to cook it, there would be nothing to link that to finding a recipe for
it.
If I was using a tablet PC,
you would have seen people using OneNote.
Yeah, but that's because it's got OneNote on it.
But it's actually really good.
But that goes back to the you can't buy pre-installed Linux boxes question.
Although we don't digress, I think babble.
Zornal is the one I've seen. I've never used it.
Yes,
but it's the one I've seen recommended. It doesn't do handwriting recognition, which apparently the big fall.
What's
down
the
with
point
it.
Of it then?
So nice one, Tim.
It's
note-taking software where you can't actually
take any notes. The GIMP,
well,
isn't it?
That's why we need Tim Clark's suggestion that they should do Summer of Code.
Summer of Code.
Yeah.
Oh right, nice one, Tim Clark.
Thanks, Tim.
Are we going counterclockwise or clockwise?
Let's have Matt next.
Matt,
we're going anti-clockwise, Matthew.
Yeah, that was my clever joke. Right, we've got one from Chad Godfearnon, which is one of my favourite Lug Radio names. And he says...
Godfearnon?
Yeah. Hi, guys! LRL USA sounds like a really great idea. Hey. I would love to come. And he's also going to say that he's pretty sure that several members of his Lug, fosug.org, would come as well. But I'm not sure what he's talking about. Anyway, I got the opportunity to meet Jono when he was out here in California for Scale. He shouted out beard during your presentation.
Ah, it was him.
Please pardon his Tourette's. And we enjoyed getting the opportunity to see the entire gang here. Thanks again for the great show. It makes life in Cubicle Land just a little bit more bearable. Chad in Fresno, CA.
Where would you do it? In America? Because it's fucking huge.
This is interesting because we need to talk about Lug Radio Live in America because we've had loads of people mail us. I mean, I think Jono's got...
Justin Fiore. Is also
Fiore.
Is also Fiore or Fiore? He tells you how to pronounce it at the bottom of the email.
Oh right. Oh yeah. Fiore. Fiore. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, there's been
a bloke called Greg Mefford here has also mentioned.
We are more than a little surprised at the amount of people that seem to be emailing us about Lug Radio USA. So we had a bit of a chat about it tonight, and The thing is, we only want Lug Radio Live in America if it's
good.
If it's like Lug Radio Live in England, we don't want to compromise and it to be a shitty kind of attempt at Lug Radio Live. And yeah, we might be there, but you know, people want speakers and good fun stuff and all the rest of it. So
and not the whole kind of not very corporate.
Yep.
It's all for a laugh. There's a bar next to it.
Real kind community of,
kind
of
Lug Radio Live.
And you can dance to the Macarena afterwards and
things
like that.
Macarena.
So we've been thinking, and what we'd like to do is, nothing's in cast in concrete yet, but we'd like to hear from people who are serious about doing it. We'd like to hear what
more importantly, have a plan.
Yeah, you have a plan.
We'd like to hear what your plan is, really.
What's it going to be? How are you going to actually do it?
Send us a proposal.
How are you going to pay for us to get there? It is one important thing.
Because, we need to be
How are you going to fund it without the entire event, without selling out your soul and our soul? What sort of people are you going to attract? Where's it going to be? You know, all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
really,
yeah. I mean, this isn't a... you don't have to put together a formal tender document or anything, but we would like to see some more evidence than just, yeah, we'd love to do it.
Yeah.
From, I mean, obviously, you know, the people who have mailed us have said, yes, we're interested in doing it, and we haven't said, now tell us how, but now we're saying, tell us how you'd make it happen. Tell us what it'd be like, roughly where it'd be, how much you can charge people to get in.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And if some of the proposals sound like they could be a good thing, then it may well be a possibility.
I mean, we need to have confidence that the people who claim they can organise Lug Radio Live in America can actually do it. If they can't, if we don't have confidence that people can do it, then we don't...
We're probably not going to get on a plane and fly for the 17 hours.
Yeah, we're not going to do it. Because it's not so much, as we've all said tonight, it's not so much about just going over there. It's that we don't want... We don't want our American fans to be disappointed by going to a Lug Radio Live that isn't like the one in England. So, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly the same. So, the other thing that Ak was talking about earlier on, which I think is really important, is that talk to each other about it. It doesn't have to be, you know, 100 different proposals.
Yeah, they're not competing bids.
We'd like people to work together where possible. I mean, yeah, we are going to get people who are going to compete because there's different size of America for a start.
Yeah.
But if there's people in your area, then talk about it in the Lug Radio forums, forums.lugradio.org, there's a Lug Radio Live forum there. That's a great place to talk to each other. So.
And there's no reason why we couldn't do a Lug Radio Apooza do an
What's
East Coast
an
and a West Coast.
Lollapalooza.
Oh, right. Yeah,
travelling...
Being quite serious about it, don't think it must be in my city and not in anyone else's city. So we're going to keep it secret and send the proposal without telling anybody. We'd much rather have one brilliant Lug Radio Live than lots of proposals where people didn't get together and so none of them are quite as good as they could be.
And also, if you are planning to put a proposal in, don't think that we're just going to kind of turn up, take all the glory and go home again. We will put work into this.
Mm.
You know, if you guys can actually arrange a venue and help us, because the reason we're asking for your help here is because we're not American. And we don't know how things work in your country, and we wouldn't know where to hire a venue or anything like that, or how to get funding for it.
And it was a frigging fortune to ring everyone up and ask some questions.
I mean, with Sipgate.
Where I think we could really help in terms of it, if someone could basically come to us and say, look, we've got the venue that will work, we can get people there, we can get the interesting people going to this, where I think we could particularly help is helping to organise speakers and helping to organise exhibitors, because that's where it all basically lies in Lug Radio Live. So,
and obviously also we can help to bring audience in as well.
Mm. So hopefully.
I would hope so. We've got at least four guys who've emailed in.
So, wildly disparate geographical location.
So talk to each other, collaborate together, and send in your proposals.
Please do.
Mr.
Okay, yes.
Sackman.
Email here from Tom Moiti. I suspect this is aimed at Adrian.
Yeah.
But he says,
hang on a minute.
I've always liked the VoIP technologies, and I've dabbled in the past on my computer before I installed Ubuntu. I'd like to know what Linux software VoIP phones there are, how expensive and easy to set up external kit is, what good VoIP companies there are, and what are your opinions on Linux compatibility and reliability. Obviously, the resident BAL has been around the block with VoIP. do any of you use VoIP for day-to-day communication?
You are the VoIP king, though.
Is he in the UK?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, you've met Tom.
Right, okay. Don't use soft phones, they're shit.
True.
Akiga's alright, or Akija, or crappy.
Is that what you were speaking to me on earlier?
Can you reboot your computer while you're talking to your friend?
Can I?
Reboot your computer while you're talking to your friend?
Well, but can you reboot your S3 server while you're talking to your friend?
It's a server, it never gets rebooted. An 800 day uptime, thank you very much.
But there's no reason why you couldn't have a separate computer running Akiga. Basically what you've got is you've got a separate computer running Asterisk. So you'd have a separate computer running Akiga and don't reboot it.
I think
there is something to be said about holding a phone in your hand. It feels like you're actually on the phone.
you need a phone, not a piece of software. Because that's just my humble opinion.
So, I mean, sorry, I'm butting into my own question.
It's nice to be able to walk into a cafe and have like a headset and your laptop and be able.
Yeah.
That's about the only time it's useful. But if you're at home and you're using a VoIP at home, get a phone.
You have
get an actual phone.
You gotta have your sound card.
You see me. I appreciate this is not my subject, and it is a subject, but I hate the fact that if I want to speak to someone, I have to fucking pick up a handset and talk to them. I'd much rather just kind of sit there and speak and have them speak back to me, like a James Bond film or something.
Yeah, but you do a lot with your computer that, you know, like you sometimes watch movies on that, don't you, and you talk on the phone to people.
Yeah.
So your computer's, I'd say, a bit more central than...
It's your boyfriend.
it's your boyfriend.
Most people, they see a phone and instantly know how to use it.
Yeah.
If you put them in front of Linux and say...
I
I agree.
Make a voice call.
Yeah, you've got to load up this thing, and then you've got to put your Britney Spears headset on, and then you've got to type in some meaningless number.
You do feel a bit like you were in a call center. I mean, bear in mind that he's not saying, how do we push VoIP to the wider world? He's saying, what should I do? And this is a bloke who listens to Lug Radio and has emailed us about it, and
he's
interested
phone.
In hacking on Jocosha. Yeah. This is not really like...
So, I would tend to agree with Aid here. I mean, I have at home... Like, I have a hard phone, which is a little Wi-Fi device.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Which is just great. It just sits about the size of a mobile phone. I have a headset stuck into it most of the time, so I can just stick it in my ear and talk away. And that's kind of what I use every day now. I don't actually have a standard phone line in my house.
What about
anymore.
Providers? Because you were talking about, I mean, a provider I'd not heard of before.
VoIP, VoIP.co.uk.
Yeah.
They were actually recommended by me from someone in the business.
Because, I mean, I've been using Sipgate from the early days, and they didn't have a very good name originally. I mean, I personally have had no problems with them.
I think Sipgate's quite a good name.
Well, okay. I know what you mean. You know what I mean.
Sorry.
So, cool. Yeah, I mean, you get your number free with Sipgate, and apparently you do with VoIP data.
Yeah, most of them. I mean, the other thing I would say about soft phones, though, I mean, there's the two things. I've got, I do run a Kiga as well. Because sometimes when I've been having sort of chats debugging stuff, sometimes it's easier to pick up the phone and call somebody.
Yeah.
And it's actually a lot easier to do that on a soft phone if you're actually sitting on the computer and typing in a way. The other thing is, the great thing about a soft phone means you can go and, you know, it's in the default install of Ubuntu. I think he said he was using Ubuntu there. It's you can actually dial that up, set that up today with the free account you get off the internet.
Off of Ikiga.net, so you just start it up and bang it up.
Or if you actually want to replace your phone, you can go to Sipgate or VoIP.co.uk or any of those who will give you a phone number that rings that phone and you can call out on normal phone numbers.
Yeah, real, actual, proper, real phone number that all people with real phones can dial.
And
cool.
The soft phone does let you set it up very quickly, get it working and decide whether you like it or not before you invest in the hard phone.
This reminds me of when we used to have voicemail for this show. I dialed it the other day, so it went...
So don't ring the voicemail number.
Next email. So probably not the advice you're looking for, but there you go.
But Aid's a VoIP expert.
Am I?
Yes, okay. You are. Well, you bloody know it.
You're about to be paid to be one.
Oh.
Controversial.
It's a Lug Radio exclusive. Anyway.
Is it?
Was it? No. Have you announced to anyone yet?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough then. It's not a Lug Radio exclusive.
Matt was looking worried there, like, oh my god.
That was one of those moments where everyone's like looking at each other.
Where we forget that it's a record, not a live show.
Are we allowed to say that John is working for Canonical? By the time this goes out, will that be public?
It's revolutionary. It turned into the Drudge Report.
Also working at Canonical, Scott James Remnant, read an email.
Actually, I don't work for... Anyway, no. irrelevant detail.
Well, sounds interesting, though. Gossip.
Gossip?
No.
No.
After the show.
This is... So, just... Actually, I picked this one out because, just talking what we were talking about earlier about, that community is helping people contribute if they are able. If they're able, yeah.
Carry on.
Michael Courtson writes, Dear Lug Radio team...
Contribute or fuck off.
I sent you a cartoon raccoon as a proposed replacement for chin.lugradio.org.
You did.
Imagine my surprise and delight when I heard that you read my email on your show. Imagine my surprise and delight at the massive bollocking I received.
Oh, even though you sent a fucking 80 gigabyte
tick for having sent you a tick file. How unfair. He goes on to say, like, his wife had a scanner, so he had to use her computer and software, and he had a choice of TIFF, PCX, or BMP, and hopes that he did make the right choice.
What a choice.
And he does mention that in the spirit of good humour, appreciation, and fair play, I emailed the image to myself, converted it in image magic for you. Here's your fucking PNG. fucking happy. Sincerely, Michael Kotzen.
What was he using? Microsoft Paint or something?
But that's right. He actually was, because he was using his wife's scanner on the... Because probably, unfortunately... on Linux, his scanner wasn't supported. Accepting contributions from the community, was it fair to kind of rebuke him for sending him the file?
Was it fair to not encourage his cartoon raccoon?
On the one hand, I have to admit, he did send a contribution and we did ridicule him. and that's exactly what we said, that not only shouldn't we do, but that people don't do. On the other hand, it was a lot more funny to take the piss than actually to acknowledge his contribution. That's the only reason why we read your emails.
So are we saying thank you for the recoup?
Yeah, thank you for the recoup. We will not be replacing that on chin.logradio.org. That's our recoup.
What would be nice, though, is why don't we have some links at the bottom of other people's raccoons? Click on the link. So send in your raccoon.
Am I raccoon?
I'd love to see what people's raccoons are.
Yeah. User contributed raccoons.
Yes, absolutely.
No, Scott's
user's
idea. Am I raccoon or not?
Yes. Right. I've got two very small emails.
I know you
have. Anyway, moving swiftly on. From Philip Quinn, he says, Freespire Distro Watch. He says, maybe Freespire thought if they put an accidental error, they would get a free 10-minute advert in a popular open source software podcast.
Damn.
He says, there's no such thing as bad publicity, unless you're Tony Blair. Just a thought. Thanks for that. And the second thing is...
What do we think? It was all a big scam designed just to get us.
I actually have one here from Magnus Thurning, who suggests that the only explanation he can think of are two words. Summer intern.
I'd say in terms of whether they did it to get a Log Radio beard.
they might have done it to get publicity, but I'm not sure about this whole no publicity is... Any publicity is good publicity.
Also, we've had an email from Brian Riley, who says, let's keep this short and to the point. He says, number one, bring back the truke.
He says, we can't do the truke anymore. We recommend all the books we know.
Season four's book truke.
The truke. And he says, number two, I love your show, been listening since last year and eagerly await the start of fourth season. Thank you very much. Number three, bring back the truke.
A lot of people seem to be wanting the fucking book truke.
I think we should do it.
He's not the only guy who demands the return of the truke.
Version four.
Season four. Listen out for it later in season four.
Yeah, let's
stick the Fook book
truke. I've got to read another book.
And someone's cut off your index finger since, so it might be quite difficult.
Talking of reading a huge book. I just threw one email on the floor. It was a whole page long. You know what?
Thanks for your comments.
Yeah.
thank you for your contribution. Thank you very much for that, yeah.
Anyway, Christopher Yeman writes, getting new users. So I was watching the video of Log Radio Live and Unleashed season finale, and I thought the discussion of how to bring people into the community was very interesting. I thought the most interesting point was the need for increased local infrastructure so local users can easily help each other out.
Yes!
I just wanted to give my point to the discussion. I think the greatest thing we can do is in schools. We need to indoctrinate users so that young people... So their first experience of computers is Linux. And he's talking about all ages from 8, 9, 10, all the way up to 15. And that way a whole generation of users will have learnt from doing. From his limited experience at summer camps, Windows is the first computer that they see. You can't have a private conversation.
Sorry, we just realised that we
had a private conversation.
Sorry, hey, carry on.
All right, I'll carry on. Recap one sentence that I just said. You can't, can you?
We were just
not paying attention to your own show.
No, it's fine.
Are you carrying on, are you?
No, Ax just waggled a finger saying, don't say what we were talking about.
You can't say that in a minute.
So do you agree?
Yes.
This is one of those dangerous questions. Matt agrees, I don't agree.
I don't know what he said.
Neither do the rest of us.
Well, shall I go on to his second point then?
Okay, go on.
Whatever. Moving on.
Thank you for your contribution. Open source 3D graphics drivers from Tony Whitmore. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Says, you've probably had loads of people point this out already, but here goes equals 20. You can equals 20.
Yeah, yeah. The script occasionally goes a bit mad and quoted printable escapes thing.
Shut up. You can do 3D using the open source Xorg drivers on some cards. I have an ATI Radeon 7500 and another card, which do. And basically saying... it's perfectly possible to get 3D using the OpenDriver if you have the right card. So I imagine his point is that you should choose your hardware according to whatever you
search your purchases.
He's completely right.
Search your working.
It's unless you have no choice, and the only card you can buy for your computer and motherboard is one that isn't supported by the free driver, in which case you probably need to buy your
Or indeed you buy a laptop. You are shit out of luck.
Buy a different laptop. Or off, if you go to like any big name manufacturer and buy their equipment, you're often stuck with what they get.
It's weird being disappointed when you look at a laptop spec and it's got a really high-powered ATI card in it. And you think, I wish it had a really low power.
Intel integrated graphics. 810, which I discovered today, was perfectly capable of running AOGLX.
In fact, mine does.
So my crappy little ThinkPad Intel graphics chip might run thingy.
If it's an 810, if it's got anything,
if you've got a ThinkPad, my friend runs it.
Has that got Intel graphics in your ThinkPad?
Yeah.
The comp is stuff isn't actually very hard. It's not very hard working on the process.
Tell you what, though, I mean, the lesson here is, as Scott says, buy Intel. Just go with your feet. If ATI will not do it, buy your feet.
Wait until AMD build their own integrated graphics chips and then release drivers for them, hopefully.
One was supposed to put until then, purchase ATI or something.
And around about that time, you can go skating in hell.
Incidentally, we've got some ThinkPads at work, right? And
Which work?
Oh, sorry, Open Advantage, not Canonical.
You don't work X-work. There anymore.
On these ThinkPads, I've got ATI chips in them, and I thought, okay, I'll get edgy on there, I'll get all of everything up and running with all the compis shit, and I thought, I'll install the ATI driver because I'm not
because I love the proprietary.
not quite, but anyway. I went to download the driver, and it turns out that ATI's official driver doesn't support their card in that particular laptop. I couldn't believe it. I thought that their drivers supported all ATI cards.
No.
I know that they've got like two drivers, one for one range of cards, one for another range of cards.
One for 4GLs and one for Radeons.
They didn't even support it. I could not believe it. They recommended using the open source drivers, which don't do the job, unfortunately. So
they do for a few of the older cards, certainly, as Tony said.
But these are like new laptops, you know, fairly recent ThinkPads.
There's your problem then.
ATI don't support their own cards. So,
by the way, Christopher, I'll try and read your email on the next show.
Christopher E. Mon, the Trinidadian in New York.
Yeah.
So okay, excellent.
Are we done?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Got a couple of more.
We must be quick. We've got
four minutes
left.
Okay, Bongo from Roger Light. He says, way back in the distant past, every time you used to mention Ubuntu, you'd also say they drink it in the Congo.
They do.
He's just sending us to umbongo.com/downloads where you can watch the actual advert itself. So I think that brings us to the end of the email section.
I think so.
Okay.
I've just been passed an email which is saying relinuxradio.org, Stuart Langridge.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Gavin Henry, they bought linuxradio.org and pointed it at our website, and they've just renewed it. So thank you very much for that. That's really kind of you. And thanks also to Russ, who bought us another
domain name of some kind, but I can't remember which one.
Yep, and thank you to my mate Bill, who pointed mychin.org at our website.
And also, this has got nothing to do with Lugradio, but he wanted me to mention it. There's a guy called, I think his name's Pete Savage, who's one of the Ubuntu guys, who's been working on, and he got the new sounds that have gone into Edgy.
Oh, right.
He's a really nice guy, and he deserves a mention. So I just thought, you know, it's nice to mention people who do cool things. And
what's his hacker name?
It's CBX.
What's his hacker name?
No, that's Michael. Tell
him my fucking granddad saying stuff like that.
Oh, no.
CBX33.
Yeah. Pete Hello. Savage. Yeah.
Is he a tennis player?
Peace
so you're thinking
of
fantastic. Well, it's been a great show.
It has.
Yeah,
been great.
Thanks very much to Scott James Remnant.
Thank you, Scott James Remnant. And, three shot Remnant.
Yeah. Cool.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.